and welcome to Science on Radio National Summer, the last in this series of great science events recorded across Australia in 2011. I'm Corinne Podger. Last week we explored the extreme universe. This week it's extreme human beings. Because today we're asking, how long do you actually want to live? A century or longer? There's a whole swathe of science and medicine devoted to extending human life, with talk, although it sounds preposterous, of lifespans of up to 1,000 years. All kinds of implications there. Space for a start, not to mention resources like food and water. The good folks at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas put that question to a panel whose members are used to facing up to tough dilemmas. Ethicist Professor Julian Savulescu from Oxford University in Britain, Professor Fiona Wood, former Australian of the Year and founder of the McComb Foundation. She also heads up Royal Perth Hospital's Burns Unit and is well known for her invention of spray-on skin. And Dr. Brad Partridge, Research Fellow in Public Health at the University of Queensland. It's Immortality Reality? And your host is the director of the Adelaide-based Royal Institution, Dr. Paul Willis.
It's said that there really is only one certainty in life, and that's death. The idea that taxes are inevitable has been shown to be wrong by several rich people. And death itself may no longer be inevitable, and it will probably be those same rich people who will be leading the way, using new technologies to extend life, not just on biblical proportions of hundreds of years, but perhaps to 1,000 years. Perhaps people being born today will be living to 150 to 200 years, and within our lifetimes, someone will be born who may live to 1,000 years of age. Is that not an inspiring and terrifying thought? What would it actually be like living for 1,000 years? And what effect will it have on the unborn? What rights do we have to live for 1,000 years? There are so many questions that arise out of this, and we have a wonderful panel to discuss these matters. Please would you welcome Professor Fiona Wood, Dr. Brad Partridge, and Professor Julian Savulescu. To start the discussions, Professor Fiona Wood will be familiar to you all from many stages, not least as the 2005 Australian of the Year, largely in recognition for her work with Burns victims from the Bali bombings and other tragedies, but also as a judge from the New Inventors on the ABC, and of course as the Reader's Digest voted most trusted Australian. I understand that that's since been revised, but she's still right up there, ladies and gentlemen. So much so that I left my car keys with her at the beginning of the event. Would you please welcome Professor Fiona Wood?
Thank you very much indeed, Paul, and thank you, RIOs, for asking me to come along today and to be part of this extremely challenging discussion. And as you heard, I'm from the medical end of the spectrum, and what is it that I can put on the table today? And so when I think back at the changes that have brought us to 2011 and the changes that are in our quality of life and the environment that we enjoy, from a health perspective, I think the vast changes have come really around population health, clean water, clean food, infection control, around vaccinations. All those things have changed our longevity over history and over time. But when you look down the other direction, into the crystal ball, and try and think about what's it going to be like in our future, I think we've got sniffs of what it could be like. Understanding our genetics will give us opportunities to tailor healthcare in such a way that maybe we could change the outcomes considerably from things that we know today are so devastating, and in particular, cancer and injury. And so can we understand how some people who are injured are predisposed to infection and a much worse outcome, and therefore change that? So how can this go forward? For 20 years of my life, I've been looking at regeneration, skin regeneration. I see scarring every day. I see people's bodies change devastatingly every day. And I just think, well, you know, we've got to be able to do something better than that. Is there some way that we can sort of look at our understanding of self-organization and tissue regeneration such that we can change the way we age? I'm here today because I'm interested in this. I'm interested in it for my children, my grandchildren, and those behind. I'm interested in it because of our planet. I hope that you are too. Thank you.
Next up, Dr. Brad Partridge, with a background in psychology that's led him into research in public attitudes towards a range of new areas of research and technology, as well as public health and bioethical implications of those developments. From the National Health and Medical Research Centre, he's a postgraduate research fellow in public health at the University of Queensland. Please would you welcome Dr. Brad Partridge.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Paul. Firstly, I want to say when we're talking about immortality, we could probably make a distinction between immortality in the sense that you could never die of anything. You're invulnerable to all kinds of things that could put you out of existence. Versus life extension. Now, we don't have to be immortal, but we could have lifespans that are very long indeed. And the idea that we could live to 150 or perhaps 1,000 years or beyond is an interesting one to look at. I think 150 is going to be a little bit more doable than 1,000, but there are a lot of very enthusiastic people in the life extension debate who would say, look, 1,000 years, that's just around the corner. And the idea that the first person to live to 1,000 might be alive today, well, that just depends on how quickly we can develop these technologies. The quest for a technology that's going to do that has a pretty old history. I think one of the most interesting things to look at is something like calorie restriction. There have been a lot of studies that show that putting animals on a calorie-restricted diet actually helps them age slower and live a lot longer. And we've known this since about the 1930s. This actually happens with a whole host of species when you feed them about 50% fewer calories, still with all the nutritional requirements that they need, they actually live a lot longer. So the question is, could this actually work with humans? Now, some people voluntarily put themselves on a calorie-restricted diet. You might not be surprised to know that a lot of these people are in America. They're part of the Caloric Restriction Society of America. They voluntarily eat a very, very small amount of food in the hope that this is going to produce these calorie restriction, life-extending effects. Unfortunately, some of the side effects of this calorie-restricted diet are very lean muscle, that have very bony bums, these people, because there's no muscle. It kind of hurts to sit down. Also sort of does funny tricks with their libido. They tend to sort of not be so interested in that kind of thing anymore. So maybe a calorie-restricted diet isn't going to be for everybody. And the idea that you're going to have to eat a lot less, though, you know, in today's modern world, that's not that appealing. But the good news is that there's a lot of research going on in developing a pharmaceutical pill that could actually mimic the life-extending effects of calorie restriction without you actually having to eat any less. So this is the kind of ultimate have your cake and eat it too kind of technology. Maybe we'll develop pharmaceuticals that they're called calorie restriction mimetics that we could just sort of take, and this will help us slow aging. Now, this kind of sounds a little bit funny, but there are pharmaceutical companies at the moment who are trying to develop these calorie restriction mimetics. One of them, called Sertris Pharmaceuticals, was purchased a couple of years ago by GlaxoSmithKline for about $750 million. So big bickies here. They're quite serious about developing this kind of thing. Now, some researchers have said that an effective calorie restriction mimetic might be able to extend our lifespan to 140, 150 years and maybe produce 90-year-olds that look like 50-year-olds. So what we thought would be a good idea to do is ask people what they would actually think about living to 150, slowed aging. So some of the research we did at University of Queensland was doing just that. We did some interviews, some focus groups with different people that we thought might have different perspectives on this, and asked them, would you want to live to 150 with slowed aging? The results were kind of interesting. We got about 65% of people saying that they'd support that kind of research, but only about 35% of people saying that they'd take the pharmaceutical pill that could help them live to 150. This kind of runs against a few assumptions that people in the ethical debate have about life extension, and there are very strong pro and con viewpoints on this. Some people say that this is really going against nature. Other people say, look, we really need a war on ageing. This is just barbaric that people would still say it's okay for you to die of ageing, but you know, not of other causes. Now, the thing is, in the bioethical debate, people have assumptions about what the public is going to think about this. Some people say, well, everyone's going to be horrified. And other people say, well, look, everybody's going to jump at this first chance they get. And what's interesting about public attitudes towards this kind of thing is they're actually seen as one of the major impediments to developing potential life extension technologies. And that's because people who are enthusiastic about life extension think that everybody's really against this. And that if it's going to actually progress, if we're actually going to get the technologies, we need to get public support on board. So I might just finish up there.
Don't know about you, but the thought of living for 150 years without cheese, good food and libido, that's a new definition of hell, surely. We'll explore that in just a moment, but please, the next speaker that we have is the director of the Oxford Centre of Neuroethics and the Institute for Science and Ethics, professor of practical ethics at the Uehiro Chair in Practical Ethics at the University of Oxford, and the Sir Lewis Matheson Distinguished Professor at Monash University. He's recognised as a leading commentator in the media regarding ethical issues arising from the creation of the first living cell from synthetic materials. So with a very strong background on the ethical issues, would you please welcome Professor Julian Suvalescu.
So let's go forward to the future. It's 2013. We've had bird flu and swine flu, but now a very rare form of flu emerges from the Tasmanian devil. And this is an extremely contagious and lethal flu. And in the next year, it kills 30 million people. Now, just to put that into perspective, the great Spanish flu of 1918 killed 20 million people. Now, what should we do with the Tasmanian devil flu? Should we just allow nature to take its course? Of course not. We'd spend billions, trillions of dollars in attempt to deal with a pandemic that was killing 30 million people per year. Now, there is, at the moment, no Tasmanian devil flu, but ageing kills 30 million people per year. 100,000 people die every day from ageing. And a further 50,000 people die from other causes. Ageing is by far the biggest killer of people. The diseases that you will all die of are actually the symptoms of ageing. Cardiovascular disease, cancer, Parkinson's disease, type 2 diabetes, all of these diseases are actually the symptoms of an underlying disease, and that is the disease of ageing. So the big picture on this perspective is, why don't we care about ageing? Why don't we invest the sorts of resources that we invest on treating flu or treating cancer or heart disease? Because there is no reason that humans have to age. We've seen already in other species organisms that don't age. There's a jellyfish called Pteroptosis, which is immortal. Turtles lived for 150 years because they have very effective anti-aging mechanisms. We've been able to genetically engineer mice to live twice as long as normal mice. There's no reason in principle why, in addition to using regenerative medicine and stem cell therapy, we couldn't understand the basic biology of ageing and attack the disease at its root cause. In fact, we spend very little money on ageing research, and I think this is the greatest scandal of modern medical research. A number of years ago, someone surveyed the National Institutes of Health, the most prestigious research body in the world. It spent 0.02% of its budget on fundamental anti-aging research. There are a number of reasons for this, which I don't want to go into. But ethically, it's an outrage. It's a scandal. It's as if letting the Tasmanian devil flu continue to kill 30 million people per year every year. That's far more people that die in any war, far more people that died in either of the major world conflicts last century. Now, people raise philosophical objections. One of them would be life would become mundane or boring if we were old. There's, in fact, no empirical evidence to support this. Survey after survey of people across the ages show that, if anything, life satisfaction and happiness slightly increase as people get older. The things that cause people to be unhappy or dissatisfied with their lives are diseases, illnesses and disabilities, not the mere fact that they're 80, 90 or 100. If you look at the surveys of happiness and life satisfaction, there are a U-shaped curve with the low point at about in the 40s. And then they increase as you get older. So there's no evidence that people find life boring or uninteresting, though they find disease and disability painful and want to be rid of it. Another issue is how long each generation should live and what obligations we owe to future generations. Whatever these obligations are, they must be fairly weak when compared to the interests of our generation, because none of us thinks we have an obligation to have children. Now, Brad mentioned the attitudes of the public. Imagine that I develop a pill that slows down the ageing process, so you no longer age but die at a certain point. So you can pick exactly at what point you want to just die quickly of so-called natural causes, once the pill stops having its effect. So you could choose to dial up an age of 100, 150, 200 or more. How many people would choose to live 100 years or less? Show of hands. How many people would choose between 100 and 150? How many people would choose 150 to 200? More than 200. Okay. Well, as you said, there's a distribution. But the important point is, how many of you think that your view should determine what other people do with that pill? And that surely is the most fundamental point to start with in this ethical discussion. The only good objection to this is somehow we consume more than our fair share of resources. We have too big a carbon footprint. It's the kind of common concern where we're chewing up too much of the world's limited resources. Those are reasons to limit people's age. But we don't yet know what level of population, what size of population, and what length of life is ethically most optimal. Until we find that point, surely we don't have an obligation to die or to impose death on other people. That's precisely what we do when we fail to prosecute a war on ageing. I'll finish by saying that we have within us the capacity to defeat ageing by fundamental basic research on the processes that cause cells to age through regenerative medicine and so on. And I think it's an urgent ethical priority that we pursue this. Thank you.
Perhaps in the discussion, let's start from the most basic question. Why do we age? I mean, our cells, as long as we're alive, continue to divide and renew. So why do we wear out? Why do we age? What's the science of ageing? Fiona.
Well, I'd be stepping outside my area of expertise here. I see that trauma, repeated trauma, is associated with a secondary sequelae, that in repairing that trauma, the quality of the repair is downgraded, if you like. And in our data linkage research, that we can see there's an increased incidence of cancer associated with trauma. We see that with sun trauma and melanoma. You know, so we see that the external wear and tear has an impact on the cellular function as the cells are stressed. So is the aging response a response to our environment, those stressors of the environment? That's one way of looking at it, but I think there's others that would certainly look at it from a cell having a defined lifespan and beyond which it cannot continue to replicate. That's a really interesting question, because there's a lot of evidence now of cells in culture going on forever.
Because surely even if you wrapped yourself up in cotton wool and made sure you didn't have any serious injury during your life and that you minimised the incidental injury you get from every day, even in those situations, you're still going to grow old.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it might also be the case too that, through natural selection and evolution, I mean, we have genes that are very good at getting us to reproductive age and making sure that we're able to have offspring, but then probably don't care so much about what happens to us many decades after that. So, you know, that might also contribute to this process whereby we eventually just deteriorate.
Because you do have the situation of telomeres, don't you? Like the ends of the shoelace on strands of DNA, which get progressively shorter, and when they wear out, your DNA's knackered. I think that's the technical
term. It's like a fuse, isn't it? And it's tingles, it's smoking away. I'm not so sure.
Professor Fiona Wood voicing some uncertainty there in this panel, Immortality Reality, recorded at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas last year for Science on ABC Radio National Summer. I'm Corinne Podger. The other panellists looking at how long we could feasibly live and whether we should are Professor Julian Savulescu from Oxford University and Brad Partridge from the University of Queensland. Our host is the inimitable Paul Willis.
Well, okay, what are some of these technologies that are looking to be implemented to extend life extension? Coming back to telomeres, there's research into just gluing new bits of telomere on, isn't there?
That's right. When cells replicate, they lose the little caps of DNA at the end of the chromosomes. And there's an enzyme. Telomerase is actually the enzyme that might be able to replace the DNA at the end. And there's the thinking that maybe if we can find pharmacological interventions that can perhaps do that, then we might be able to stall the ageing process that way.
And then there's stem cell technologies. What sort of stem cell technologies can be introduced to make us live forever?
I mean, stem cell technologies are really interesting and holds a whole, opens another whole can of worms. I remember not long ago my mother, who is over 80, ringing me and said, "Do you do stem cell research?" And it was clear from the tone of her voice all the way from Yorkshire that she'd been talking to somebody down the street, you know. And I said, "Well, it depends what you mean by stem cell research, Mum. Do you mean, you know, umbilical stem cells, adult stem cells, you know, embryonic stem cells?" She says, "If you're going to be smart with me, I'll put the phone down." And I think there lies the issue, you know. We don't understand a lot of what we're talking about. And we need to be able to articulate what we're talking about. I think the work around cloning is interesting and we can learn a lot from it. I think work around transfer of cell lineage from a skin cell to a muscle cell or to a cartilage cell is fascinating from a scientific intellectual point of view, but it also may give us the clues to how these cells can then be used in replication. If we consider our skin turns over between 6 and 8 weeks. It sheds and it's continually replaced. There is a stress on the system just doing that. Where do the stem cells from the bone marrow are coming into the skin and replenishing that, and that sort of wears out over time. Can we boost that? Can we boost the bone marrow? Can we do stem cell research without getting ethically compromised by going to an embryo? Can we actually just boost our own bone marrow? So the stem cell research question, I think, is something that we can use is an enormous engine of opportunity for understanding. And we can do that without going near the ethically compromised area, I think.
But there's the potential...
Just add one thing on it. So you're talking about current prospects for stopping ageing. There are diseases where people prematurely age. So at the age of 20, these individuals look like they're 80 and they die by the age of 24. And there are effective treatments now and understanding of the biology of these conditions. There's work on helping to improve DNA repair so you don't get the mutations, the changes that lead to aging. And there's the prospect of various kinds of stem cell research, for example, treating Alzheimer's disease in the long term or other age-related degeneration of the brain. But the important point to realise is that we haven't really scratched the surface in terms of the manpower and the ability to marshal the scientific resources that we have. In the same way as we've done with other animals, where we've been able to double lifespan. So calorie restriction, these sorts of... This is just a very premature foray into what could be, you know, a very productive line of research, but we just don't spend the money.
Because, I mean, we're theoretically on the frontier at the moment where we're not far off being able to grow new organs from your own stem cells, which would theoretically do away with the ethical questions of where the stem cells came from. So, you know, need a new kidney, you can go in there and have a kidney transplant with a kidney grown from your own somatic material. Wonderful stuff, but you're saying that there's the research dollars aren't being put into those sorts of things? Or?
Well, to be honest with you, the politicians don't want us to live to 150.
What are we I'm not sure we want them to either, to be honest.
People are struggling with life expectancy in the West is continuing to increase, and people are already struggling with what to do with, you know, an ageing population in terms of social support and so on. And we struggle even to increase or remove the retirement age. So we're completely politically and socially ill-prepared for radical advances in the area of this science. So, you know, we need two things. We need the money put into the research, but we also need to think through what kind of society, what sort of social institutions do we want, not just for people who live to 100, which is what they're likely to live to, you know, in a number of decades, but to 150 and so on.
I was just interesting, just, are we running the risk actually now of, for the first time, the life expectancy actually turning around? You know, people making poor choices on a daily basis, that's what I see the results of, around drugs, alcohol, and obesity. I mean, if you're obese and you have an injury, your outcomes will be extraordinarily compromised, and your offspring is going to be compromised. So are we actually, by taking this sidestep almost and avoiding the issue, as you've said, and spending all our research in tinkering around the edges of malignancy or research in Alzheimer's and things and not really taking it sort of head on, we are actually running this sort of risk of it starting to actually turn around and decrease.
Can I just say something on the funding aspect here too? I wonder if some of it has to do with the fact that we don't generally consider ageing to be a disease, and that maybe if we actually rethought things and classified ageing as a disease with all the hallmarks of other common diseases, that it might garner more funding support for politicians, their constituents, you know, die of things like cancer and heart disease and Alzheimer's and things like that, but they don't necessarily see themselves as dying of ageing. And so maybe that, you know, policy and funding decisions could change in that way.
Well, let's move the discussion on then from could we to should we? Because I was quite interested in the response from the audience to the straw poll that you ran there, Julian, as to who would want to live for more than 100 years or 200 years. I was actually surprised how many people don't really want to live for 1,000 years. And I can identify with that, particularly if it's due to calorie-restricted diets. That does sound like a nightmare. To me, I can think of two problems with life extension, and that is, one is the question of the quality of life, which I'd like to come back to in a moment, but the other is the productivity, in that what's the point if people are going to be able to live for 200 years if for 100 of those they are not able to make a significant contribution to their own welfare and to the welfare of the community that they live in. Being alive is one thing, but actually being a functional part of the society is an important part of life.
Well, so fortunately, the answer, there's very few problems in life where the answer is simple. In this one, the answer is simple, because if you slow down ageing, not only do you delay death, but you delay disability and illness. And there's no evidence to suggest that older people are inherently less productive. What reduces productivity, creativity, is decline in capacities and capability. So if you turn off the decline in intellectual capacity, if you retain the flexibility and ability to learn of a 10-year-old child, but you also accumulated experience, wisdom, etc., if anything, it would go the other way and you would expect people to be even more productive and the world to be a much better place. It's just that we have this prejudice against ageing that we see people who are older as necessarily infirm, incapable, incompetent. But that's caused by the ageing process. It's not caused by being a human being.
Well, coming back to the quality of life then, question...
Should increase.
Pardon?
It should increase.
Well, surely the biggest question on the quality of life as you get older is degeneration of the brain. And that's the tricky one. I mean, kidneys, livers, most of the other organs of the body, it looks like we're going to be able to regenerate them. But the brain itself looks like it's going to be a tricky beast to deal with.
But that's a function of ageing. That's just, you know, every organ shows the symptoms of ageing in a different way. You know, the kidney stops filtering, you know, urine as effectively. The brain stops functioning as effectively. But that's nothing special to the brain. It's just how the brain manifests ageing. You turn off ageing, you turn off that sort of decline.
So,
and it's all intertwined as well, in that your brain functions better with exercise. You know, you're capable of doing exercise. We know that there are certain things, certain aspects you will be able to engage better if you're actually more functionally capable. And there's a whole wealth of evidence that, you know, with certainly in animal models, where you're exercising and stimulating, and you may actually increase the DNA within the brain. So there's an element of regeneration in certain aspects, in certain areas, in certain basal nuclei. So it's actually not going to go down if you're actually physically capable. And it may be something that we can actually look at beyond the sort of single organ replacement issue and just look at the whole. And so say, well, okay, we've learned a lot from this organ replacement stuff, but how does that fit to the whole? And how does that fit with this whole person slowing down that the impact of the wear and tear every day such that you don't need those replacements?
So we're looking at a generation of centenarian gym junkies who can do Sudokus and cryptic crosswords on the treadmill.
Well, it could be worse.
Is that how it works?
Well, centenarians are actually the fastest growing segment of the population at the moment. I think closely followed by those 85 to 99. So we're already living longer. But I think the challenge is to avoid this global nursing home situation whereby we live a lot longer, but the quality of life is just not there for the last, you know, 70 years or so. And I think the brain is going to be a tricky one to deal with, because even if we can regenerate things like livers and kidneys and stop our joints from stiffening up, I'm not so sure about the brain.
What about the argument of equity in resource use? Because the longer that people live, the more resources that they're using, and those resources in a world where people politely die before they're 100, in that world, those resources go to the next generation. Are we going to see some kind of limit in that dimension?
Well, you know, why did Bismarck choose 65 as the retirement age? Because people on average at that time died at 66. So, you know, 100 years ago, people had a life expectancy of 50, yet we think that it's okay that they now live to 80 and that the amount of resources that they draw is, or 85, is acceptable. Why not turn it back to 50 or 40? In fact, through most of human history, people live into their 20s. So what we actually happen to have at the moment is just a function of where we are on a trajectory of scientific development and social development. So we need to make an active choice about what share of resources, how long people should live, and why choose 80 just because that's what we happen to have? Are we at the local optimum, ethical optimum? You know, I can't see any good reason for that. I think you need to face that question strategically and say, what size of population do we want to have? How many people? How long should they live? And, of course, you know, if you do have adequate anti-aging technologies, you can also have, you know, policies that enable people to die when they want. You can couple them with euthanasia so that you can choose when and under what conditions you die instead of having to spend 30 years in a state that you don't want to die and then die.
But doesn't the question of living longer enter into the bigger question of population growth on the Earth? China's population has continued to increase despite the one-child policy, largely because the older people are living longer, and so the population keeps growing. So do we need to consider ageing as part of the cold question of global population?
Actually, just with all the news of Steve Jobs' death, I was reminded of a quote of his that said that death is life's greatest gift because it gets rid of the old and makes way for the new. And I think it's kind of interesting looking at those kind of questions in the context of someone like his life, where we saw such a celebration of the innovation that he was able to offer the world, and within such a short lifespan too. And I guess he might be one of these prime examples whereby people will say, well, look, wouldn't it have been great if we could have Steve Jobs around for 150 or 200 years rather than just 56 or so? But I guess, you know, he was one who really embraced his own mortality in that way. But, you know, in thinking about innovations, I mean, maybe if we have life extension technologies, we're also going to need innovations in other areas of research, because maybe if we do have these large increases in population, we're going to have to find out, you know, ways of being able to use resources a lot more efficiently as well.
Time for some questions from the audience. If you have a question, we have an audience microphone in the aisle here. Please make your way to that. I think there's one up the back even further, so if you want to remain hidden, you could use the back one. But we have a question from the floor here.
Yes, I'm 70. I quite like being old, except my back is stuffed and my brain is wearing out. But what really worries me is, in deference to the speaker on the end, we have already exceeded the population that this planet can hold. I appreciate growing older. I don't appreciate my brain wearing out. If I'm going to be old and senile, or worse than I am, I'd rather have euthanasia. And aren't we going to interfere with natural selection? Or have you answered that by saying we're going to be smarter?
Let's take the natural selection question first of all. I would have thought that we actually, as a species, managed to sidestep natural selection when we started manipulating the environment rather than let it manipulate us. Am I naive?
I think we've developed our society to a point where natural selection is in our hands by the way we look at, where we've developed a level of altruism where we look after those that are weaker and vulnerable. And we do so increasingly. So I think certainly natural selection is a whole heap different from Darwin's
survival of the
fittest. Yes. Yeah, so we've certainly manipulated that. When you start to think, have we actually gone beyond the capacity of the planet right here, right now, there's behaviours which would indicate that, yes, if we continue with these behaviours, yes. But you could argue there's enough food on the planet, it's just in the wrong place at the wrong time. We need to be innovative in getting them at the right place at the right time, rather than being too much in one area and not enough in the others. So there's a lot of problems that we have to consider when we consider this issue, and it can't be done in isolation. But natural selection, whew, we've manipulated that a long time ago.
Can I say one thing on something you said, which I think is exactly the most important issue here today? It's the size of a population is the function of two things: how long people live and how much we reproduce. So you can control a population by restricting reproduction or by restricting lifespan. And what we do at the moment is we let nature take its course. And what nature does is it inflicts disease and disability. So even if you thought people shouldn't live any longer, there's still reason to pursue anti-aging research, because you'll compress morbidity so that people don't have to be disabled, sick and suffering for the last 5, 10, 15 years of their life. So even if you think that immortality isn't a reasonable goal, you should still think that anti-aging research is a goal, and people can then commit suicide for the sake of the next generation if they believe they've lived too long.
Can I just clarify? Because what you're saying is, right now, we spend the vast majority of the amount you spend on health for the individual is spent in the last 6 months of life. What we're saying is we should flip that around, spend it up front so we enjoy life quality better.
I take objection to the comment that was made about productivity. You're not in paid work, you're not productive. I'm 70, I've been retired 10 years. In that time I've done a degree. It's a great time, a great opportunity. Yes, I am ageing, knees and various things, but I hope that they put that pill out, because I'll certainly be taking it.
So the question of productivity, just to revisit that, what I was getting at there was that within the context of the society, if people are not in a fit and healthy state in this extended age, such that their contribution to society is less than what they're taking out, then that becomes a societal question, does it not?
But that lack of productivity, as to say it again, is a function of two things. Mm. One is it's a function of aging. So if you cure aging, you give people the opportunity to be productive. And the second thing that stops people being productive is a mandatory retirement age. So if you get rid of that, then people can be as productive as and for as long as they want.
Do I detect that you haven't got a superannuation plan?
No. Fortunately, there is this country called the United States where you can go and work until you die. So I'll be going there. You know,
maybe if we live to 200, we could actually have several retirements. Maybe you retire at 65 for, you know, 10 or 20 years or something, and then go back for your second career, study again, and do some work for another 30 or 40 years, then have your second retirement with all the superannuation that you'd save then, and then live to the rest of your life.
I think that has some merit. I think it's a privilege to get up in the morning and enjoy what you do. I think it is a real privilege. But when I was in the UK many years ago, I heard that as surgeons, if you retired at 60, you had a 12-year life expectancy. This is some years ago. And if you retired at 65, your life expectancy as a surgeon was 13 months. So I'm going for the early retirement and rejigging the... rebooting the hard drive. I think that's a good solution.
A life spanning more than a century, in continued good health, packed with several careers. That sounds pretty good. This is Immortality Reality, a forum recorded at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas last year. I'm Corinne Podger, and this is Science on Radio National Summer. But with any medical advance, there's the issue of money. Who's selling a therapy? Who stands to gain? Who stands to lose? And who funds the research? Your host, Paul Willis, has taken this question from the audience.
There seems to be general agreement amongst you that more funding is needed in the area of research into ageing. And you seem to indicate that the bone should be pointed at politicians. But my question is, on a different slant, the pharmaceutical companies make obscene profits, and it would scarcely be in their interest, or indeed in the interests of the sickness industry more generally, if you were to cure major killer diseases. Great numbers of people would be out of business, not only the pharmaceutical companies, but a lot of the people working in the industry.
It's an interesting point, thank you, sir, that you know, if there is a pill waiting to be developed, someone's going to make a lot of money. So why aren't the companies who make pills pouring money into this research?
I think the gentleman gave the answer. It's much better to be a pharmaceutical company lowering people's cholesterol with very little effect than providing another treatment for treating cancer, having lots of different treatments for all of these, you know, chipping away at the edges. If you were able to stop aging, there wouldn't be all of that industry. Yes, people would take that one pill or that one intervention, but it's vastly more attractive to a pharmaceutical company, you know, not to bite the hand that feeds it and let the underlying disease progress and develop all these little manifestations and provide little treatments for those without actually dealing with the problems. But the pharmaceutical industry isn't a charity. They're there to make money. So they're very smart. This is why you need government to push these initiatives, or individuals, because it's not going to be the pharmaceutical industry that wants to delay ageing. Otherwise, they would have spent a lot of money on it.
So essentially, it's the theory of planned obsolescence, but for the human body.
Yeah.
What keeps the industry going is that we do keep getting sick so that we can get cured, and if we cured ourselves indefinitely. Okay, right. Next question, please.
Well, on the statement of the second retirement, I think that some of us, and I want to also preface this by saying that a lot in the world do not have the luxury that those of us in this room have, but many of us already are in our second adulthood. I'm 55. I expect I'll be able to live another 30 years. So I think that we actually do have the opportunity to already have second lives compared to a few generations ago. My question, though, is if anyone on the panel would like to comment about the benefits of mortality as opposed to immortality. If you've ever had a life-threatening disease, which I've had, it causes you to rethink your life completely again. And mortality makes every choice we make matter in a way that I think if we were immortal, those choices wouldn't have the same meaning for us. So do you think there's actually benefit for human beings being mortal? Does it change the quality of our lives?
Well, you know, again, fortunately, we don't have to answer that profound question, because if you think that it has a benefit, we'll program it in and decide at what point you want to be mortal. I can tell you right now, it's not going to bring a huge amount of meaning to your life if you're told you're going to die tomorrow. Maybe if you're told you've got 10 years to live, maybe it would be better for you than living for 20 years. But decide what it is and realise it without having disease and disability sapping what benefit you have got in your life through the process of ageing. In a lot of these questions, the power is in our hands. You can decide to put in place structures that build in mortality but don't have ageing. I personally don't believe, for myself, that mortality brings meaning to life. What brings meaning to life is the choices that you make, the goals. What mortality does is force people to set themselves goals. And I spoke to Daniel Kahneman, who's the Nobel laureate in psychology, and I said, how could you make people's lives better based on your research in psychology? And he said, there's two things that people don't understand. One is that what brings them life is not possessing material objects, but engaging in constantly rewarding relationships that require attraction or projects that require their attention and give them rewards. The second thing is they think their lives are unending and they never set themselves goals. They never set themselves a finite end to their life. So what matters is really setting yourself a goal and working towards that. It's not having to die.
So we should all establish a bucket list as soon as possible just to make sure we get through it.
I mean, at the moment you will die, so you better plan for that resource now.
It's interesting. We did some interviews with a group of people called transhumanists who are very enthusiastic about all sorts of enhancement technologies that could make us smarter, run faster, stronger, and live longer. And one of the ladies that we spoke to said that she's already writing her first 1,000-year plan. She's got a diary and she's actually writing down all the things she wants to do in her first century, second century, things I need to have done by the time I'm 500 and things like that. So 1,000 years, well, I mean, that's a long time, but obviously when Julian talks about goal setting, that's a pretty good example of it.
Let's get another question from the floor.
You talk about the quality of life for the older generations. What about for the younger generations? I'm just about to finish my uni degree and there's not many jobs available. And I half blame my dad for that. He's just now at retirement age and he's not retiring. And so we're all finishing uni and we have to continue with our part-time jobs we started in high school because there's no jobs, because the older people are still working and there's kind of no pathway where we have to study for the first 40 years of our lives before we can then start a career. Does it then set back the kind of growing up?
I think what you're saying is that this life extension idea means that we need a serious restructuring of societal ideals, such as the creation of work and how long you hold a job.
Can you imagine the generation wars too, if we live to 152?
Sure.
200
I mean, you've already got the baby boomers and Gen Y at each other's throats. Is this an intergenerational thing or calamity that we're not preparing for when we just talk about living longer?
Well, it is in part, but I'm not sure that this is the cause of the lack of jobs in Australia. First of all, we have had a retirement age. Secondly, there's the problem of a lot of labour going outside of Australia, the nature of jobs changing, and so on. But in principle, I agree with you, there will at some point be this question of how many resources are there for people who live how long and how many people. So as I said, you need to couple it with a program on reproduction, and you can encourage people to have a certain number of children. If you have less children, there are less need for jobs. You might have more children, people living shorter. But these are all choices that we can make, and we have to think about the kinds of lives that people have and whether they have jobs. But we don't think about that when we form policies on opening up markets and so on. We just fly by the seat of our pants.
Interesting, because I hear often that the job that you will have at my age hasn't been invented yet. And so maybe this is an opportunity and create something else for this planet. I mean, that really could be very exciting.
Maybe there'll be jobs like cryonics technician or something as well. There'll be people have to man the freezers.
Get to work with Walt Disney every day. I have been given the wind-up, so I'll take one last question from the floor.
I think the young lady who just asked the question would not be happy with Leopold Stokowski, the conductor, who I believe at the age of 96 insisted on a 10-year renewal of his contract. But I have a direct question for Professor Savulescu, and that is, I wasn't able to see who was putting up their hands in your little poll, and I'm just wondering, in your opinion, was it the young people who were opting for the very extended life and perhaps the older people who were opting to cut it shorter? And if so, what conclusions could be drawn from that?
Well, I didn't see. So let's just do it again and you can see. So let's just do it. Who wants to live less than 150 years? Hands up. And who wants to live more than 150 years? I can't see any real age distribution there. And I think these are very much individual choices. In fact, I don't think anyone really wants to die. My father was 88 when he died, 87. What people don't want is to be incontinent, to be unable to be independent, to do the sorts of things they enjoy. That's what they don't want. But I've never met somebody who, well, maybe there are a very few small number of individuals who really just want to die when they've got a good life, but I've never met one.
Just on that, when we asked people about that, we tried to compare answers in terms of age. We found that a lot of the young people said, oh, old people, they'll all want to live forever because they're so close to the end anyway that they'll just want to keep hanging on. But the old people said, oh, young people, they'll be the ones who want to live forever because they think they're immortal anyway. So the truth, they didn't actually vary that much.
By way of rounding out the discussion, a quick hypothetical going around the panel. There is a pill developed. It will double your life expectancy. Would you take it? Julian?
Yeah.
You're just hungry for that extra 70 years, 80 years?
I think it's also... I personally think it's a mistake in advance of being in the confronting death to make predictions that you would want to die at an earlier point because, again, my experience as working as a doctor is that once people really confront it, they don't want to die. It's the sort of suffering and the kind of loss of that continued life involves. But so I can't see any rational reason not to take the pill.
Brad, would you pop the pill?
Well, if it's the calorie restriction pill and I can eat whatever I like, absolutely. I'd be taking two of them.
Yeah. Why?
Look, for me, I mean, if I'm enjoying my life, I can't see a reason for it to end. And I think that's going to be the critical thing. If we can have technologies that can maintain quality of life, then, hey, it's worth living. There's too much cricket and football to watch.
You know? Fiona.
I'm feeling very vulnerable here with the mother of six children. So can I have a few of these tablets? Because, yes, I take it. Yeah. I think it's a bit of a no-brainer, but I wouldn't want to take it in isolation. I'd want everybody to come with me.
So an anti-aging pill-popping party.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's much more interesting than Botox.
I think for the sake of the record, I'd have to pop that pill too because I've got a model railway to finish. It's coming along very slow. Ladies and gentlemen, we've shared some incredible minds today. Would you please put your hands together for Fiona, Brad and Julian.
Dr. Paul Willis, Director of the Royal Institution, hosting that event at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas last year. On the panel were Oxford University ethicist Professor Julian Savulescu, Professor Fiona Wood from Royal Perth Hospital and the McComb Foundation, and Dr. Brad Partridge from the University of Queensland. I'm Corinne Podger. My thanks to sound engineer Miyuki Okiranta. And this has been the last in this summer series. Details and audio for all five shows at abc.net.au/radionational and pick Big Ideas from the program list. Next Sunday at this time, you'll hear The Body Sphere, presented by Amanda Smith, a new program that discusses, critiques and celebrates the human body and all the things it can do. That's followed by The Philosopher's Zone with Alan Saunders, which moves from Saturday at 1:30 to Sundays at 5:30. You can find the full 2012 Radio National program guide on our website. Thanks so much for your company this summer. Bye for now.